eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Skate Podcast on WEEI.com.
Bobby Orr, behind the net to Sanderson, Orr! Bobby Orr! Orr!
For the first time in 39 years, the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup.
Talking Bruins and NHL.
Sure, old-time hockey. Like it is sure. Yeah.
With writer and producer Brian DeFelice.
Brian DeFelice is an emerging talent.
Bridget Prue.
Yeah, he's a little bit on the hot seat.
Burn him!
And WEEI.com Bruins writer Scott McLaughlin.
Great Scott!
Lace him up for some Bees talk right now.
I'm a dog!
It's the Skate Pod on WEEI.
Welcome into episode 97 of the Skate Podcast. I'm Brian DeFelice, joined for the last time this Bruins season, I should say, by Scott McLaughlin and Bridget Prue, although we will be, you know, recording throughout the summer and whatnot. But and I say that because I hate to say I told you guys so earlier on, but turns out my prediction was correct. Carolina took the series in seven, beating the Bruins 3-2, and in a game that kind of... the score was closer than it really felt.
Yeah, I mean, they get it to, yeah, they scored with 21 seconds left from Pastrnak and then actually got the puck to the net again in those last 21 seconds. But
yeah, Marchand had like a doorstep chance, and that was like, I think that was just cruelty though to Bruins fans, like with 5 seconds left or whatever, you see like an open net to shoot into for Marchand and it like rolls under his stick. But yeah, that was just a 30 seconds of cruelty rather than just letting everybody sit back in their chair, go grab a beer or go take a nap.
Yeah. And it was so many of the same problems that have popped up in the games in Raleigh throughout this series, like chances early on, couldn't finish, gave up the first goal, got into early penalty trouble. The penalty that Taylor Hall took at the end of the first period, right after they go down 1-0, was so unbelievably stupid, and they technically killed off all 4 minutes of it, but Carolina scores 12 seconds after it ends. Like, to me, that's still on Hall. That's still a continuation. It, you know, the Bruins are still kind of scrambling trying to recover after the PK at that point.
Yeah, the play was still, you know, the play started that the goal ended up coming on. The play started before Hall jumped out of the box. So
yeah,
I mean, really, it is just a continuation of what was happening with him trying to jump on the ice and get back on D. Or it was, you know, it happens all the time. You see it. It was an immediate letdown after a great kill, which it could have been something to, you know, set a foundation for the second period. If you go in still scoreless and you have a good kill, and you know that when you were successful on the kill last game, good things happened right after. So kind of changed the complete dynamic of that when at the very end of the period, you have to kill off a minute and then you have to go in first 3 minutes of the second period. And so.
Yeah. And you know, a little bit of puck luck on that goal to make it 2-0, where Hampus Lindholm gets the shot block, but it goes, bounces off him right to Max Domi on the doorstep. But nonetheless, you put yourself in a position to fall behind 2-0, which, as we've seen in this series, is pretty much impossible to come back from against this Carolina team. Like, one goal is hard enough, and they did that a couple times to their credit. Games 3 and 4, they did come back from a goal down. But two goals against the number one defensive team in the NHL in the regular season, like, it's basically a death sentence. And, like, you, for so much of that second, third period, the Bruins were really struggling to create any chances. And a big part of it is Carolina just doesn't make mistakes. Like, their defense is just so clean. It's a well-oiled machine. And the Bruins didn't do enough to force mistakes. But, you know, sometimes when you're trying to come back, you need teams to make mistakes. Like, and Carolina just doesn't do that.
Yeah, not to mention that you fall down 2 goals to anyone and you pretty much screwed. Like, it, never mind it being Carolina, you could fall down 2 goals to Montreal and still not be able to come back. Like, it's never easy. I think the last time the Bruins did it was against Buffalo, like, many, many weeks ago. So it's never...
The last time the Bruins won after falling behind 2-0 was January 1st against Buffalo. That was the very first game after the COVID break.
And that's so, Buffalo, right? Like, that's not Carolina. And it's still a long time ago. So,
well, it's one thing if you're expecting a team to come back from down 2-0. But when you look at the Bruins coming back down from 2-0, it's not a team trying to come back from 2-0. It's, well, now David Pastrnak and Brad Marchand, they need to come back from down 2-0 because you're not getting anything from your bottom. You know, I mean, Charlie Coyle here and there, but their bottom six offensively has been, like I said a few weeks ago, going into the playoffs, like, it's not a high-end quality bottom six production-wise. It hasn't been there all year, and you can't expect it to happen in the toughest time either. So just very, very one-dimensional, and, you know, you're looking at, you know, the two lines, hopefully, that can produce offense instead of four, and or at least three. I mean, like, you can't – you're watching that game, guys. Like, do you have any confidence? Like, okay, maybe Marchand or Pastrnak and, you know, Bergeron or somebody, DeBrusk or Hall, like, maybe those guys can sneak one in, or maybe McAvoy can, you know, get something going from the blue line or something. But do you watch that game when they're losing and say to yourself, oh, I have – any confidence in Thomas Nosek or Trent Frederick or Craig Smith doing, or Nick Foligno? Guys, there's literally nothing happens. And, you know, I just thought that they were very sloppy. They're very sloppy with the puck, just like slapping at it, not protecting it, not possessing it, not a lot of purpose, not a lot of energy. You know, obviously somebody like Pastrnak was getting double shifted a lot, so I don't want to question like a lot of the top guys' efforts. They just didn't really come through, you know, most of the regulation. But throughout the lineup, guys, it just felt like it was a back-to-back in February. It did not feel like it was a Game 7. For Carolina, it felt like it. But for the Bruins, it just, for the most part, it was sloppy and just kind of, I don't know. They just weren't there.
Sloppy with the puck and without it. And Bruce Cassidy highlighted this in his post-game press conference. Like, what was most frustrating to him was that two of the goals came on just – defensive breakdowns on stuff that, like, they practice all the time and pride themselves on. You know, like I think it was the first goal of the game, they have three guys back, like all three forwards get back, but no one picks up Jacob Slavin at the point, and he has like all day to pick out a pass to the doorstep, and then it's one more pass and it's in for the goal. And it's like, and both times it was the third line, because then the next goal that we mentioned, you know, right after the Hall penalty, the third goal of the game, the third line's out there again. And again, they get the numbers back, but everyone just like goes to the wrong place. Frederick gets caught kind of in no man's land, can't get a stick on the centering pass, and Coyle and Forbort are sort of like staring at each other with neither one picking up Max Domi. And it's like, that's something that, you know, the Bruins are generally pretty good at, is defensive zone cut. Like, usually when they get caught out of position in the D zone, it's after like long cycling and, you know, eventually someone loses an assignment. But in this case, they're both off the rush. And like, the Bruins were you know, statistically one of the best rush defenses all season. Like, that's something they've been really good at. And that's two goals that basically came off complete breakdowns in their rush defense. And it's like, you know, to your point about like the depth forwards, like at the very least, you can't get scored on. And that third line gave up two tonight. And you look at their numbers for the series, some of these depth guys, and it's just brutal. I mean, Charlie Coyle in the series was on the ice for 0 5-on-5 goals for and 7 against. Jake DeBrusk.
In game 7, he was on the ice for all 3 goals.
Yeah.
Against.
Jake DeBrusk, 1-4-7 against. Taylor Hall, 2-4-8 against. Hall, a 3-4-6 against. Like, it's, you know, you can't have that. You can't have, if those guys aren't going to be scoring at a prolific rate and producing 5-on-5 goals, at the very least, you got to take care of your defensive business and not get scored on. And all series long, you know, I would argue from the second line down, you know, second line had a couple decent games, but basically everyone other than your top line struggled to keep the puck out of the net.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's dating back to, you know, last summer. You know, when you see what this roster is looking like and you have no Krejci coming back and you see the guys that they bring in like Holla, Nosek, and Foligno, you know, you try to be optimistic and you try to see what Sweeney's seeing in these guys. But, you know, deep down you kind of know, like, all right, this isn't really a very prolific offensive team we're looking at here after your top guys. And, you know, the regular season is one thing, right? I mean, you're not – a playoff series is different. You're able to hone in on teams' weaknesses and whatnot. And, you know, the regular season is just, yes, they're a good regular season team. Well, guess what? There's about 20 good regular season teams. 16 make it, about 5 or 6 don't. So it's just, my point is you could see what this team's ceiling was all year. You know, in the moment, you don't want to admit it because you want to enjoy the run and hope, you know, hope for the best. But this team's ceiling was only, you know, first round, maybe second. And that ceiling was lower because their roster just wasn't elite enough. It just wasn't. And you know, it was exposed in this playoff series. I mean, again, like, just total lack of depth. And, you know, in this game in particular, it's like, you gotta be, when you're on the road, you have to be strong in the faceoff circle. And like, when you know Bergeron is going up against Jordan Staal all game, not to rehash the storyline Scott's nauseous over, but you know Bergeron's going to, at best, break even with Staal. So, like, if you're Charlie Coyle, Eric Halla, like, Thomas Nosek, like, Curtis, you have to win, your fair share of faceoffs. And it just felt like Carolina was winning the majority of them and dictating the where the play was going, and the Bruins were just chasing. I mean, the Bruins got no cycle game going. I don't know. It just wasn't great. I mean, I certainly think that the team that deserved to win this series won the series. You know, I tweeted some arbitrary number out, like, towards the end of the game. But if, I mean, of the 21 periods these two teams played, I honestly feel like Carolina soundly outplayed the Bruins in at least 13, 14 of the periods. And the Bruins may have outplayed them in 7 or so. I just think Carolina, they were more consistent. Even in the games in Boston, they had their moments. The Bruins never had their moments in Carolina.
I'm waiting to hear the inevitable Scott McLaughlin column about, you know, regrading the – because in the beginning of the season, he did the grades on all of the offseason acquisitions, and let's see where he came back down, because I know he had given Hollow, like, the worst grade, and then, like, Foligno went incomplete. So, I mean, now you got a complete look. Well, Scott, you can do another assessment.
Scott, real quick, like, can you give me an assessment on somebody who wasn't brought in this year but last? Like, what the hell happened to Craig Smith? Like, he's a volume shooter. He's not even getting shots. He was invisible. Yeah. Invisible.
It was crazy. Like, obviously just an awful series for him, and a couple games where he got sat down for pretty long stretches and would end up around like 10, 11 minutes.
He only had 10 minutes today.
Yeah, exactly.
He only had under 4 minutes by the end of the second period, under 4 minutes.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm sure he's been dealing with something, and maybe we're going to find out in, you know, these next few days whenever they have their breakup day that it's, you know, something serious, maybe it requires surgery. But, you know, it's the old cliche though. Like, if you're out there, you've got to perform. I mean, if it was so bad that he couldn't give you more than this, then maybe he shouldn't have been out there, you know? So like who knows on all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, clearly struggled down the stretch in the regular season. Really most of the season, honestly. Like, there were stretches where he was good and it looked like he was getting going, and then he'd go cold again. And I don't know. I've always really liked Craig Smith as a player. I thought he was really good last year, especially down the stretch and you know, the first round against Washington. But yeah, I mean, I think you have to hope that it's an injury that really limited him, because otherwise, I don't know how you explain that sharp of a downturn. Like, he's not at an age where that should be happening. It shouldn't be an age thing. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't really have any answers other than what everyone saw, which is that he was pretty much invisible for a large chunk of this series.
The injury stuff, though, it's a tough sell for me, because I totally acknowledge it and understand it's a real thing. But I guarantee you there's probably five or six guys that were just doing a storm surge after the game at center ice that are going to require offseason surgery, and they're going into the second round. And, like, so it's everybody deals with it. Everybody deals with it. And I don't know. I'm not saying he should have been out there with, you know, five goals in the series, but, like, he wasn't even generating anything. And, you know, he was – you know, him and Frederick and Coyle just got exposed on certain back checks in transition throughout the series, and whatever. It's just disappointing is all. I mean, like, it's one thing to expect, like, 5 to 10 goals out of Nick Foligno going into the year and not get it. It's like, I mean, when you look back at his stat line, okay, great, Craig Smith finished the year with 16 goals and, you know, whatever, probably 20 assists, whatever it was. It's, like, not a bad year, but, you know, he just wasn't who you needed them to be. And he's one of a few, you know, many guys that falls in that category.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on, like, the whole, you know, signing depth this offseason and prioritizing that. Because we're going to, you know, maybe this podcast, maybe another, like, we can get into, you know, what the future holds for Don Sweeney, and his contract reportedly is up this offseason, you know, according to numerous sources, like, he's not signed for next season. And, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there. Like, I think there's still a lot of people in the organization who are loyal to him and who probably want him to stay and are close friends with him. And Cam Neely might be one of them, and that might be the one that matters the most. But he did not have a good offseason last year. Like, this was his plan A. Remember, all these signings were on day one of free agency. The Bruins were by far the most active team on day one of free agency. Foligno, Hala, Nosek, Forbort, and Ullmark. Those were the guys they identified. Those were not fallback options because they missed out on other guys. You know, and look, ultimately, the Ullmark thing, I think, worked out fairly well, all things considered, you know, given, like, all the uncertainty around Tuukka and him ultimately not being able to play. Like, all right, like, sure, that's fine. Forbort, yeah, it was a monster on the penalty kill, but again, that's one part of the game, and it doesn't negate you know, ineffectiveness at 5-on-5. And, you know, I mean, look, their plan going into the year is to play Forbort with McAvoy, and that failed. That failed so quickly and so obviously that, like, just salvaging him as, like, a decent third pairing defenseman was the best you could hope for.
Yeah,
you know, Hala easily matches contracts. Like, there's one who early in the season when he was a depth forward really struggled. You put him with skilled players, he was. You know, he put up decent numbers. Like, it's hard to argue that with that cap hit. But in the playoffs, Holler really struggled and only looked even decent when he had both Hall and Pastrnak, right? And same goes for Taylor Hall, by the way. Like, I'm not saying that's all on Eric Halla, but you take Pastrnak off that line, and that line was completely invisible. Foligno, obviously not worth the money. $3.8 million. And, you know, he did, what, scored two goals this season?
He's, like, consistently has, like, the fewest minutes per night. Yeah. Like, he's just not contributing. And he went from third line guy to fourth line guy to, you know, just a guy that you put in there because, you know, he's just going to, you know, give a little bit of identity, a little bit more toughness to your lineup. So yeah, that one was really, that one gets the worst grade. Haula, I think when Scott was hard on him when he first gave the grades, he definitely had more upside than when Cassie found the right place to put him. And I, the Ullmark thing, no problem with. The Nosek and the Foligno and the Forbert, I mean, that then you end up having the same problem this offseason, right? You didn't nail it. You didn't nail it. So we're going to go into this offseason with the same problems. Besides goaltending, goaltending has been taken care of if you're happy with Ullmark and Swayman, but pretty much everything else.
Yeah, by the way, with a lot less money to spend this offseason, right now, you know, barring any other moves, they're set to have about $4.4 million in cap space. Like, that maybe gets you Bergeron if he wants to return on a cheap contract, and that's it. Other than that, you've got to trade guys away to free up salary and try again. But it's like their number one issue last year that everyone knew was they didn't have enough depth scoring, right? Like, second round against the Islanders, when the top line went quiet, they didn't have nearly enough behind them. And Sweeney's way of addressing that wasn't – it was quantity over quality. He signed depth guys who were slated to go into those third and fourth line roles. And instead of spending that money on, you know, a real impact second liner or top four defenseman, and saying, you know, okay, we're only going to sign two guys instead of four, but they're two, you know, higher end guys who actually make a real impact. And, you know, so he took this approach instead and it didn't work. They didn't, in the end, they did not have more depth scoring this year than they had last year. So it ultimately didn't work. And, like, you know, you, like I said, if it weren't for Holla kind of lucking into him at least being a decent fit between Hall and Pastrnak, it would really look like a disaster. You know, but, like, and everyone's like, oh, well, you know, the response will always be from, like, you know, well, who was out there? And I'll keep going back to someone I've mentioned before, but Philip Danault, who you saw plenty of because he was with Montreal, so you should have had a pretty good book on him. And he went to the Kings for I think it was like $6 million a year, and had a really good season, and has been a big factor in the Kings taking the Oilers to game seven. Now that game is just about to start while we're recording. But, you know, like, that was there. Like, that, there's an actual second line center that makes a real impact and doesn't just have to get kind of elevated by his two wings. Like, Philip Danault has driven a line with the Kings this season, and that was the kind of player that, again, okay, you sign one of him, you don't get to sign two third, fourth liners, but I feel like the approach that Sweeney took ultimately didn't work. They needed impact guys, not just more depth guys.
They needed a second line center. They didn't really, you know, completely nail it. Obviously, we mentioned Hollis stepped up, but replacing Krejci was always going to be a difficult thing to do, and replacing Tuukka obviously wasn't going to be easy either. Not saying, like, he played great in last season, but he's still, you know, Tuukka Rask, and trying to move on from him and start the new round of goaltending was going to be a difficult thing to do. And now you're looking at an off season where last off season it was Krejci. Is Krejci coming back? Speculation and whatnot. And this year it's Patrice Bergeron. And by the way, guys, next year it's going to be David Pastrnak. So just going to be like this every off season, you know, in the foreseeable future, where you got these big guys that have been, you know, the foundation of the team that since back when they won the Stanley Cup, I mean, geez, 11 years ago now, doesn't feel like that. You're having, you know, Bergeron, Krejci, and then now Pastrnak coming up, not this offseason, but the next offseason. So, and the Bergeron speculation is going to be, it's already off the charts. I'm already over it. Obviously it's a big subject. Yeah. Scott's already writing about it. It's a huge subject, but at this point for me, the reason why I'm just like, can we not? First of all, we're like a few hours postseason, and Bergeron spoke and said, you know, it's too fresh. It's too raw. I'm not ready to make a decision yet or whatever. Nobody knows. Anybody who tells you they know what he's doing right now is just, they're kidding themselves. I don't know. You don't know. I'm not even sure Bergeron knows. Like, that's why I'm waiting. I'm waiting for, I mean, you got to cover it right off the top. I guess Scott's doing that. And I guess you can write your columns, you know, what do the Bruins do if Bergeron does leave, does retire? Like, how do they approach the offseason differently? Whatever. But up until that point where it's like, we're right down to it, I'm already sick of it.
See, that's a problem to me, though, because the Bruins aren't learning from their mistakes. Like, I said this to you guys last summer, and it just drove me up a wall. It's like, since Patrice Bergeron's been on your team since 2003, 2004. David Krejci came along in like 06, 07, mainly 07, 08. My point is, for about 14, 15 years, you had your 1-2 center combination. And you never considered what life would have been like without them. And you never prepared for it. The fact that last year they went into free agency with no replacement plan for David Krejci besides, maybe Jack Stanika, which, by the way, lost year. Where's the development with him? And if it's, and you know what? Maybe it's on the player, fair enough. But it's like, that's just a total lost cause now, which sucks. And then, you know, they bring in Holla. It's like they just have no plan. And now with Bergeron, so what? Are we just going to wait and see what happens and, you know, get stuck with the thumb up their ass? Like, it's you have to prepare. Like, you can't just be blindsided by things. And I'm not saying that right now they should know about Bergeron, but it's like they need to press him before it's too late this summer. Like, what's the deal, Patrice? And maybe he's waiting to hear what the GM situation is going to be next year. And so, you know, and also their lack of, and I know it's easier said than done when you're not having high draft picks, although they have had high draft picks in 2015, but let's not go there. The lack of drafting and developing at the center ice position, and just in general, forced them to go shopping last year. Like, you shouldn't be spending an accumulation of like $7 million on bottom six forwards. Those are forwards that you could just grab from the minors. Like, you pay for high-end guys. You don't have to pay for those guys. You should be able to bring those guys up. Like, there's enough of them. Like, can Oscar Steen and Mark McLaughlin and, you know, Anton Bleek, can those guys do for you what, you know, Nosek can do? Yeah, I think they can. What Nick Foligno can do? Yeah. By the way, Nick Foligno, guys, he didn't even have a shot beat a goalie clean this year for a goal. His two goals were, like, you know, off his skater, like a rebound on the crease. He didn't even beat a goalie clean all year. And the
remember when they had him on the power play top unit?
Yeah. October was a good time.
Great net front guy.
October was fun. But then as far as like veteran leadership and toughness, like, you know, yeah, like I like him, but I must have missed the part where he was dropping the gloves all year. So really, what was he bringing you? Anyway, I'm going to pose this question to you guys. Do you think Don Sweeney should be the guy to lead this team forward?
I would say, so if Bergeron returns, maybe, but if there's like a real rebuild here and a real resetting of the roster that has to happen, it would be hard for me to trust him to be the one to do that. You know, I think his strengths as a general manager have been, you know, locking up his own guys, which should not be dismissed. And a willingness to be aggressive when it comes to trades. And we saw that again this year with Hampus Lindholm, which I think was a good trade. You know, I think we probably signed him for a little too long, but whatever. Is a solid enough signing. Like, you know, Lindholm looked good in the playoffs for the most part. So I'm okay with, you know, with that move. And obviously addressed a need that was there because it still hadn't been addressed earlier. But I feel like there's too many cases like this where he is too late to get to something. You know, how long have, like Brian said, how long have we been talking about the need to have that next center? And it's like your cracks at it have been Jack Stanika, a second rounder, Johnny Beecher, thirty-first pick, basically a second rounder. Those are long shots. Those aren't guys that you're taking high. Obviously, we know 2015, I guess they thought that was too early to try to address that they had, you know, enough years left to Bergeron and Krejci that they didn't need to then, because they had those three first round picks and didn't take a center, didn't take Matt Barzal, didn't go out and sign, like I said, Philip Dano, like didn't think they needed to spend that kind of money at that position last offseason. I think that was a mistake. So yeah, if Bergeron leaves, if Bergeron does retire, like obviously they have to do something. And, you know, look at the free agent market. Like, who would it be? Nazem Kadri is the only, I would say, like surefire top six center.
He's going to require so much, but he's going to get a huge contract. Like he's going to get an absolutely massive contract. And if you're already up against the cap, like you, also very well liked guy in Boston.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. You'd go from having, you know, your
most likable to the most hateable in Boston, at least. Kadri is not, you know, he's one of the guys, he gets on the ice, he gets booed. You go from the complete opposite.
Yeah. And you put him and Marchand on the same line. And now you got to worry about having two guys on your top line who can get suspended at any given moment. Like that's not ideal either. No. Other than that, it's like Evgeny Malkin, I think it's either Pittsburgh or nothing for him. There's not much out there. It's, you know, Claude Giroux, he already said no to Boston once. I don't know, maybe he decides to pull a Jerome McGinley, but he's also 37 years old, or, you know, whatever.
So that does not solve your long-term issue. No, right there.
No, there is no long-term center solution. And like, that's part of why it's, you know, really, it would be really hard for me to trust Sweeney. Like, how long was getting that, you know, top left shot defender an issue? Like, you knew Zdeno Chara was getting older, and I guess you took a crack at it by drafting Vaakanainen and before that Zboril, but like, I don't know. It's just, it's been too slow to address clear organizational needs. And now at a time where you're going to have to, you know, because I don't think a full teardown is in play or should be in play. Like, not when you have Charlie McAvoy and Hampus Lindholm locked up and Jeremy Swayman, you know, hitting his prime in the next couple of years, and hopefully David Pastrnak locked up. That should be a priority this offseason as well, as get that.
Oh, yeah. Don't let it get to this point.
Yeah. Get the extension done now. Don't let it get to his final year.
Don't let it be a story at the end of the season. The first thing everyone's tweeting out and writing about is, are they going to sign David Pastrnak? Like, but don't do that. I mean, look at what happened when that happened with Krug, like Krejci. Every single time it's bit you in the ass.
At least that's in their control though. Krejci and Bergeron, that was just, they were waiting on word for them if they were retiring or not. Like at least Pastrnak, like they can control that right from the get go. You know, anytime they want, really.
Yeah. And so to answer your original question, Brian, about management, I try to like go through the mistakes he's made and like what to give him credit for. And this season, something that I give him credit for that we didn't know how it was going to play out in hindsight, it worked out for the Bruins. Obviously, they don't go on a deep Stanley Cup run, but he handled the DeBrusk situation better than I think other people might have, because there was a lot of pressure on him to do what DeBrusk wanted and what his agent wanted. And he ends up signing him, not trading with the deadline, which was the right move in hindsight, and also signing him to a contract extension, which, you know, keeps a few possibilities open for the Bruins. So he doesn't mess that up, doesn't mess up, in my opinion, Allmark. That's fine. Trade deadline, you know, Lindholm extension, fine. Hall, those are, that's a good extension. And as of right now, it looks like that. So those are a few things that I think he gets credit for. And then you just have to think about, I honestly think they're going to give him another year. When I really think about it, they're going to wait to see just how much it hurts for him to not have made the moves he should have made a long time ago.
Well, I think, I mean, to me, if they bring him back, it's going to be for more than, you can't go year to year at the general manager position. Like, you're making too many, decisions, long-term versus short-term, and doing, weighing that, where, like, if you're telling Sweeney, you know, we're going to give you one more year, like, we'll give you a year and then reevaluate, well, then every move he's going to make is going to be only next
short-term,
year in mind.
Yeah, short-term, but yeah, I mean, listen, I just feel like they're not at the point yet where they're 100% sure that it's time to move on from him. Maybe they should be. I'm not saying they shouldn't be. I think that, you know, if you think about it, if you really judge that your rebuild is coming in the next few years and that you like want a guy that's good at drafting and making the moves to like reset an organization, you have to make that move now, probably.
By the way, PSA, we officially have the Battle of the Sunshine State in round two. So Toronto's misery lives on. I mean, got 60 goals for Matthews, their best regular season ever, and they're out in one. And look, that's another thing too, like, to bring it back to the Bruins, like, this playoff structure is not going away. So you can keep having these 100 to 100, you know, 5-point seasons, but, you know, if you aren't built to beat a, you know, contender pretty much in the first round going forward, then, you know, you're rolling the dice. Like, you want to be able to have a roster that you feel comfortable with going into round one playing anybody. I guess to give my own response to the Sweeney question that I posed, I think it really just depends on what Bergeron does. If Bergeron, and I think Scott may have said this, but if Bergeron decides to leave this year, I think that the Bruins need to have a GM who is willing to make some very, very unpopular decisions if need be. And if ownership prevents them, well, then that's a bigger issue. But what I'm referring to is if Bergeron retires and there's no real, you know, big fish in the free agent market or a trade to be had, you know, you're not going anywhere. You might, I'm sorry, if you don't have a number one center, even with the guys that they have currently, I don't think they're making the playoffs without Bergeron next year. You know, I guess unless they would have spent money on a bunch of guys, but it's, my point is if Bergeron goes and you don't have a suitable number one center to replace him that following season, you might as well kick the tires on trading Marchand while he is still one of the best players in the league, because having one of the best players in the league on your roster wouldn't do anything for you without the rest of the roster being in place, and you can, you know, start to build that. But I don't know if Sweeney's the guy for that, for a full rebuild.
Well, here's what I would say, though. I almost think, like, that would almost have to be something that Sweeney, like, would have to do, because I don't think a new GM can come in here and one of his first moves trade Brad Marchand. Like,
yeah,
but you're immediately putting yourself behind the eight ball and having fans turn on you. And
yeah, it depends. It does depend, though. Like, it depends what transpires before that. Like, if Bergeron leaves, and, like, you know, Bruins fans are very, very, I shouldn't speak for all of them, but Boston's a very, very educated sports town. Like, the fans kind of get what's what. And I think that, like, if Bergeron leaves, like, fans would be like, yeah, they're screwed. And if a guy came in and was able to trade Marchand and get, like, you know, at least two first rounders and a couple of good NHL players, like, who knows? But regardless.
By the way, correct me if I'm wrong. Bruins don't have a first rounder this year,
they don't.
Do they?
No, they don't. And they do not.
And they don't have a third rounder. They do, or no, but no, they have Calgary.
From, I think it was
so, and they don't have a fifth round. Like, this draft is just like a patchwork unless that they can make some sort of move to get into the first round by packaging something.
Look, the play that they're hoping happens is that Bergeron comes back. If Bergeron comes back, I don't have an issue with Sweeney coming back to kind of, you know, see this thing out. Bergeron comes back, Marchand comes back. You'll have Lysell next year. He'll come into your top nine as a winger, I would imagine. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, he has like what, 20 points in like 7 playoff games so far over.
Yeah.
I might be saying his last name wrong, but the Merkulov kid, Merkulov from Ohio State.
Merkulov, yeah.
Merkulov. Bridget, your friend at the Bruins Network says that his ceiling is top six, you know, top two NHL center. So
he's definitely the best center prospect they have, no question.
Yeah, and a complete steal.
And that leads us to one other thing that Sweeney has done well, which is identifying NCAA prospects to sign. You know, that's somebody who he just pulled out of a hat. So, like, he deserves credit for that move. So if Bergeron comes back, like, you know, and you bring in some young blood with Lysell, we'll see what happens with DeBrusque. I don't know what the deal is with that. I do think the Bruins could be better. I think they will be better next year. I think they'll drop some dead weight. You'll get some fresh faces where you need it. But if Bergeron goes, that's where this whole thing just, like, becomes an absolute, you know, who knows what happens.
Yeah, and another thing on Sweeney, since we mentioned, you know, this year's trade deadline, and, you know, I think we all like to trade for Lindholm, and that's why you don't have your first-round pick. That's fine. But let's also not forget that as part of that deal, you know, we threw in an extra pick to free up cap space and didn't use it, didn't find a deal for another forward. And, you know, as we were just talking about, like, forward depth was an issue in this series. You know, you thought you felt okay at the time because especially the top three lines, but really all four lines were clicking pretty well and playing well at that time. But you get into the series and, like, Trent Frederick was on your third line and he ends up as a healthy scratch for three games and then comes back and takes penalties and struggles defensive. Like, you know, I still think Trent Frederick is not a third liner and should not be on your third line. To me, his ceiling is like good fourth liner. Like, I think that's what he is. And I don't see enough offense from him to ever think he's going to, you know, really be a solid middle six forward. You know, they didn't go out and get that forward. And, you know, like, I'm not going to be a hypocrite here, because at the time when we were talking after the deadline, I looked at the prices for some of those guys and thought, you know, I don't know if I would have paid them, but I mean, Rickard Rakell got traded.
And got hurt.
Andrew Kopp got traded and has been pretty good for the Rangers. You know, we've been like the, you know, everyone criticized the Hurricanes because the only move they made was for Max Domi. And look, I generally don't like Max Domi as a player. I don't think he plays defense at all.
Except game sevens.
And by the way, he struggled with the Hurricanes for a lot until game seven, when he just had two goals and an assist. And
yeah, he had two goals in 25 games with them. And then all of a sudden game seven, he has two goals. Yeah. So, but that's a good example. He's a good example of, you know, by the way, they got him. When we talked to Sarah, it made more sense why that was the move they made, just because of the whole retention of 25% of his cap that came with that deal. So they kind of got him for relatively cheap. And they didn't have much space to do much with anyway. So you see, and not even in just Max Domi, a guy that was added at the trade deadline for Tampa Bay, Nick Paul ends up being the difference in that game seven today. So that's a forward that they added at the deadline who was not like a significant name on anyone's board that ends up coming through in game seven with two goals, just like Domi did. And we did the post trade deadline podcast, like, was it enough? We had other guests on. Was it enough? Did they need to add a forward? general consensus was yes, and you see it bite them. The defensive depth was also tested in this series against Carolina, with McAvoy at one point getting COVID or whatever was going on with that, and Lindholm getting injured, and then, you know, needing to take Grizzly out of the lineup just as a healthy scratch, and he didn't play the last two games. So there's clearly a lot of moving parts, and you have so many things you need to fix. What are you supposed to do? Like, your hands are tied.
Yeah, well, like I said, like, in order to add anyone, they gotta trade people away and free up some money, or buy people out. You know, Nick Foligno could be bought out because he's going to the last year of his deal, and that saves you some money. You know, because you just mentioned defense, like, that's going to be a really interesting spot, because you basically have seven defensemen signed to real NHL contracts. You know, obviously Lindholm, McAvoy, Carlo, Forbort. Well, Clifton's on cheap money, I guess, but Riley and Grizzly, like, is there room on this roster for both of them? Because those are two players who obviously bring a lot of the same characteristics and would play regularly without question on most NHL teams. But based on this postseason, like, one of them's out. that's just the lineup that the Bruins have right now. And I don't think either one of them is going to be happy about that. You know, if they're both here, they'll go into the season and they'll battle for it. And, you know, from like an organizational standpoint, you never have too much defensive depth. All things being equal, the Bruins would love to, you know, have all those guys back and let them battle for playing time. But does it make sense to have $3 million or more tied up in, you know, someone who's in and out of your lineup? Like, you could also,
but to be fair, those guys weren't in and out. Like, Mike Riley played a majority of games. Matt Grizzly played a majority of games.
Yeah, because they had no Lindholm.
Well, yeah, but then you got Hampus Lindholm, and one of them was going to be out.
True. Now they have, you know, the odd man out. And Clifton is a cheap contract, but he's someone that comes up in the 23-24 season. He'll be an unrestricted free agent. So, yeah, just looking at it right now, it's just, that's going to be an interesting thing to see, because obviously Grizzly and Riley they can bring similar things, but Grizzly's still with a higher upside. They're both the same age as well. They're both 28. So Grizzly with a slightly bigger cap hit than Riley.
Well, I mean, it's almost a full million. What is it, like 700 more?
It's a 687 more.
Yeah,
I mean, 687,000 more.
It's enough. So he's making more than Riley, and you can probably get more for him if you were to trade him.
Yeah, you absolutely could get more for him.
If you're asking me, I think you move Grizzly if you're choosing between the two, because yeah, I think Grizzly's ceiling is higher as a player in the regular season. We have seen now that ceiling doesn't translate to the postseason, and a lot of it's because he can't stay healthy, and that's because of his size and stature. And St. Louis was the first team to recognize it. Going forward, any playoff series the Bruins play with Matt Grizzly, their opponents will know. Dump it into his corner, rough him up. Simple. You saw it with St. Louis with Sundqvist. Like, you saw it with the Islanders. You saw it with the Hurricanes. Like, that, the book is out. At least Riley has the physical size to withstand some of that. And also, like, you know, we'll see what happens with Mason Lowry, who's on the rise. Like, he's going back to Ohio next year, I think. But, like, you know, could he be like a, you know, later half of the season addition? Like, you don't know. So
Jakub Zboril is an unrestricted free agent, but Mark Diver reported a little while back that there had been talks and there's some, you know, mutual interest in getting something done there. And it's probably going to be pretty cheap because
the injuries that he wasn't able to prove himself as much as he probably would have this season.
Right. Like he was kind of just starting to emerge where you're like, okay, like Zboril might actually be an NHL defenseman now. And then he tears his ACL. So I can't imagine that, you know, he's going to get signed for much. So that's another depth option to have on the left side. And, you know, someone who brings some physicality too.
And he had played his way into the top six at one in the early parts of the season before the injury. So I think he is somebody that people probably forgot about a little bit and faded into the back of people's minds. I've seen him up on the ninth floor a few times. The other day, I almost bumped into him on accident, throwing something away. But yeah, so that's a good point. I mean, obviously, you look a little bit behind in the depth chart, and there's Jack Eshon under a million, but
yeah,
he's coming up as a restricted free agent. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just think like if you trade away Grizzlick, I think that or Riley, you know, one of them or both, I don't know, like I don't care. like you won't hurt from that for long. Like I said, like help is on the way. Zaboro, like you said, Lauri, if not next year, the one right afterwards. Like that left side will be shored up. You know, sooner than later. But I'm just looking at their roster right now, guys. So you have 800,000 with Lazar. That'll be gone. You can buy out Foligno, right? So now you're looking at what, 4.46?
You wouldn't lose all of Foligno's cap here. Like it gets spread out over a couple of years or however it works. But
okay. Any other forward contracts that stand out that could be movable or bought out?
Well, I mean, what's going to happen with DeBrusque? Is his trade request still open? Does he still want out?
And right at the trade deadline, it was reiterated by his agent.
Yeah. So is that still, you know, what do we hear in these next few days or weeks or whatever that he still wants out? In which case, you know, don't you have, like, you have to try to trade him again. And I kind of feel like you can only push the, you know, well, we're not getting enough in return. Like, you only ride that so long. If you go through another offseason of that, like, that's a full year from when he first requested a trade. And I get that, you know, DeBrusque has done that to himself. Like, he's the one who signed this extension that he didn't need to sign. So, you know, if he ends up, you know, if he wants a trade and doesn't get moved this offseason, they have no one to blame but themselves for signing that deal.
Yeah, that was still a very puzzling trade deadline move. I'm not completely understanding it, because I thought once they extended him, that means he was getting traded to someone, but clearly that's not what happened. And you know what? He did make his value.
He was one of their better. He was
in the playoffs.
He was one of their better forwards in the playoffs. I mean, straight up.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Absolutely. He was the only guy that got on the board in game seven. Like he was working a lot harder than we'd been seeing him work, you know, right around the time he requested the trade. You know, kind of turned his season around, was able to definitely increase his trade value. And maybe that's all he wanted to do was, you know, try to get more people interested, help himself out in that way.
But again, you better not lose that trade, because the Bruins were anemic offensively, and he was one of the few that was providing. So if he goes, you got to make sure you get something in return that's worthwhile, because otherwise, like, he's under contract with you. And, you know, game seven, you know, a bit of a soft play on the first Domi goal in the corner. I don't know how Domi comes out with the puck with McAvoy and DeBrusque both there. But again, he made up for it with a goal of his own, so wash that out. But I thought he played fine in game seven, especially compared to the rest of his teammates. But like, another name I'm looking at here, guys, is like Craig Smith, 3.1. He's up in 2023. He's a right wing, third line right wing. Okay. Don't you kind of feel like a young Swedish right winger could be in the top nine on the right side next year, maybe? That might push him out or somebody.
Yeah, so actually, I was just going to bring this up when we're talking about DeBrusque, because like, I could see Lysell playing in the top six, and then, you know, I look at him like, hey, Jake DeBrusque could be, you know, a nice fit as like third line left wing, clearly an upgrade over Trent Frederick. But is Jake DeBrusque going to be happy doing that? Because
when he was
playing in the bottom six, he wasn't happy, and that was part of all this that's gone down. So
yeah, he wasn't happy, and he wasn't next to guys that could elevate his game. Like, he was with guys that were dragging it down, if anything.
Yeah, well, he should be like, if he ends up on that third line next year and that's where he plays, like, he should be the one elevating that line. Like, they should, and maybe somebody needs to tell him this and, like, you know, pump him up or whatever, but, like, it should be, hey, Jake, go help lift up Coyle and Smith. Like, if that's the line and those guys are back. But, like, you know, we've seen enough. He played well enough down the stretch of the season into the playoffs that it's like Jake DeBrus shouldn't need line mates like lifting him up at this point in his career. Like, he's good enough to, at least on a third line, I'm not saying like drive the first line, but like he should be someone who can drive a third line, like who can, you know, not just be an extra piece there, but like an actual force in that kind of role.
Can I ask you guys a question? Somebody that I've been watching.
Are those your notes, Brian?
Yeah.
You got a lot of notes. He's shuffling all these papers.
It's one page of notes on top of like 20 blank pieces.
Is it like your final report before graduation?
Yeah, exactly. My question is, a player I've been watching off and on the last few years, especially, you know, when he's on national TV, is Tyler Seguin, because I'm fascinated with how he has just fallen off a cliff. I'm honestly speechless. Like, he literally does nothing out there anymore. His speed that he had over others when he was younger is no longer there because people caught up. How this ties back to the Bruins is, are you guys concerned that might end up happening to Taylor Hall next year or the year after? Do you think that he's getting up there, 30 years old, 31? Do you think that the league might start to catch up to him too? Again, because his
that biggest... was very insulting to Scott, by the way.
Why? Oh, no.
he's hockey, going downhill. He's 30, 31.
Hockey age is different. I guess my point is the biggest similarity between Seguin and Hall, besides being 1 and 2 in the same draft and both playing for the Bruins now, was that their biggest asset was speed in an era where, you know, they were kind of alone at the top. But everybody has speed now, so I feel like their biggest assets are kind of like, you know, neutralized. And so I guess, are you guys concerned that Taylor Hall can continue being a top six winger, you know, production-wise? I mean, he had 60-plus points this year. Great. I'm not saying I'm seeing it. I'm just asking if you guys are concerned, maybe.
I guess a little. Like any player who gets into their 30s, you've got to, you know, start thinking about that. But to your point, like, I haven't seen that yet with him. I still think when he gets his legs moving, like, it's clear that he's still not just faster but a stronger skater than most guys on the ice, and the way he can protect the puck, I think he's still very effective with it on his stick. What, you know, what worries me about Hall though is just the way that the huge drop off that his game took when Pastrnak wasn't on his line. Like, I think clearly the idea that, you know, for so many years, right, it was like you only would even have any semblance of a second line because Krejci was there and he could almost single-handedly elevate a line enough to at least be a decent second line. You know, I think going into this year, by not signing a second line center, the idea was that Taylor Hall was going to be that guy who could almost single-handedly elevate a second line. And I feel like it should be really clear right at this point that he can't do that. I mean, look, it's harder to do that from the wing than at center. But it's clear that he needs at least one elite player with him, whether it's at center or the other wing. Like, things clicked, obviously, when he was able to set up David Pastrnak. That was a big help for Taylor Hall's game to give him someone that, you know, that could pay off the chances that he was creating instead of, you know, otherwise it's like, okay, Hall has the zone entry and comes to speed and then passes to who? Like, someone who's not going to finish. So what's the point?
Right.
You know, so that, like, that's what would worry me, and especially again, if Bergeron retires, like, everything's so off, but it's like, okay, if he's gone, then Marchand would need Pastrnak, and can't have Marchand, Hall, and Pastrnak all together. So then, like, Hall would still need someone. And it becomes a mess. Like, right now, I just think the Bruins are a team that this season had four top six forwards, and going into next season, I don't really see how they add another. But so on a Hall, like if Bergeron comes back and it's still Bergeron and Marchand and DeBrusque or Lysell on their right, and then it's Hall and Pastrnak together again, and maybe it's Hollow, or maybe they find someone else, but I think you'll be fine. Like, I think that'll be okay, and you can work with that. But the idea, the dream that Taylor Hall was going to be able to drive your second line and, you know, kind of be like almost a star player from that position is, I think, kind of out the window. But I still think he can be a really good second liner for at least a couple more years to come. But he's got to have really good second liners with him. He's not going to lift up two third liners.
Yeah, and he's got 3 years left on his four-year contract. And, no, that's not too long of an extension to sign him to. So, I mean, I do see the way he currently skates, and I still think he's an effective skater. He's a very unique style of skating. Like, if you look at him from the ninth floor, you always know when he's got the puck because he just skates a little bit different than everyone. But I'm not worried about it at this point. Tyler Seguin, I think, obviously when they both had speed, they both used it to their advantage, but I think Tyler Seguin relied on it more. He just did. And Hall has been able to probably adjust through the growing pains a little bit more than Tyler Seguin has.
I guess the reason I bring it up is just because...
because they're from the same draft, and
it's because
I'll also say this. I also think Taylor Hall is a real, and this goes back even to when they were drafted. Like, people would say this then, and I think it's remained true. Is Taylor Hall is a real student of the game, and if he sees certain things in his game that aren't working, he's gonna study his ass off and work his ass off to figure out a way to make it work. Like, I mean, the guy's an encyclopedia. Like, when you talk to him, he knows like everything about everyone and every tendency.
I don't think
Sagan's ever been that player. Like, not to say that Seguin didn't care, but I don't think he ever really like lived and breathed hockey 24/7 and studied everything every team and every player was doing the way that Hall seems to, where it's like, he's got like a book on like every player in the league. Like, he knows everything about everyone.
So why is he not? Okay, because the reason I brought it up, guys, is because I was watching Seguin in the Flames series, and he might as well be Trent Frederick out there. That's how little he does for the Stars now. And with Taylor Hall in the Carolina series, I thought he was pretty good in game one, but like, there weren't many shifts where like he just like took over and showed why he was the number one draft pick in this league. And you know, game six after Carolina made it 2-1, like, he and Hall and Pasta had a great follow-up shift, and then they had a second good follow-up shift. But if you're that good of a player, which he's a great player, but like, when you're that good, how do you not have a few more dominant shifts? Like, he's just out there. You know what he looks like, guys? You know the bubble hockey game at youth hockey rinks where the guys are on a stick and like they just glide up and down the ice and like they're moving fast, but they don't look like they're moving fast? That's what Hall looks like a lot of times. He's just kind of like, he's watching a lot and not acting as much. And for somebody with so much skill and talent and hockey IQ that Scott alluded to, it's like, well, where are the dividends?
It's maybe here, so he there, maybe all it. The all of the information makes you overthink stuff sometimes.
That's a good point. It could. It really could.
Can. And just to finish the thought on Hall, he comes across as one of the more intelligent hockey players in the league. Every time you talk to him, he has a very like high level of emotional intelligence, and you can just hear in his answers, he never dodges a question. He's always able to handle the questions and insightfully, and you know, you can tell that he comes from a place where he cares, he pays a lot of attention, and he will call himself out when he needs to change things. And he, you know, he knows what he needs to work on. So that is at least, they both have completely different personalities. We've known that from the beginning, him and Sagan. So sometimes people think it's going to be handed to them. Other times people are willing to work for it. Sagan's kind of been more of the, hey, look at me. This is my life. I have a great life, and just enjoy it, and, you know, kind of just hope it works out.
Well, he also only, Sagan also only played like, you know, X amount of games over the last like couple of calendar years because of injuries and stuff. So I just think that combined with the league getting quicker and younger just kind of was a bad combo for him. But look, I think, look, if Bergeron comes back next year, look, in goal, I think Jeremy Swayman was good in Game 7, and he was good in the series. And Ullmark wasn't terrible in the series. They're good in goal. On the back end, they're fine. They could, you know, they could use a little of this here and there. Up front, if Bergeron comes back, you bring in Lysell. Maybe this Merkulov kid can do something and earn a spot out of camp. You buy a few guys out. You make a trade. Like, offensively, if Bergeron comes back, I think that there's some good that this team can do. There's just so many unknowns right now. It's tough to really comment on. But we will throughout the summer, as soon as there's updates, we will have opinions. But right now, it's just kind of like it's tough so quick after the season ending.
Yeah, well, that was at least optimistic of you there, Brian. And I guess, once again, it all hinges on the Bergeron situation. I'm just trying to find out how big Merkulov is. Like, I'm trying to find 5'11". Yeah, that's a pretty decent size, you know, forward. So 5'11", 181. He's 21 years old. So, yeah, who knows? Well, it's probably not Stanika. That's all,
Somebody else, too, who is Beecher. I know one of you guys mentioned him earlier. When we had Buchagross on, I was like, really? Is that true? He said that Beecher was like a Trent Frederick, but not as much offensive upside. And I was like, what fucking offensive upside are you seeing from Trent Frederick? Like, how? So, I mean, well, is Beecher like less of a prospect than Frederick? Like, or what can we expect from him next year, maybe?
I think he's like in that boat. But just to put in perspective, like, Beecher scored less in college than Frederick did. He scored less in college than Nola Chari and Sean Corrali did. Like, that's – so, you know, those are, like, the guys he's going to be compared to as, you know, sort of the – I don't know, guys come up as maybe fourth liners and see where they go, but
– Was he a first-rounder? Beecher?
Johnny Beecher was indeed a first-round pick.
So you spent the first on Beecher and Frederick, and they combined for, what, 38 college goals? Attaboy, Sweens.
Yep.
Yeah, number 30 overall in the first round in 2019 is where Beecher went.
Yeah, and that was – so, yeah, I mentioned how, like, 2015 they didn't draft a center. 2019, they reached for a center because they knew they needed one and they needed more in the organization there. Like, not very many people had Johnny Beecher as a first-round pick. Most people had him as, like, a second-rounder, maybe even third-rounder. But that draft was really thin at center. And so I think they got stuck into thinking, like, we need a center. So they took the top one on their board. That wasn't a great draft overall, but there were a couple players there. Like, there was, like, Arthur Kaliev is the big one that, like, people will mention. But yeah, so I think Beecher's, his combination of size, speed, good on faceoffs, some defensive ability. He was one of Michigan's top penalty killers. Like, all that stuff might make him, you know, a solid NHL fourth liner, but I don't think he has a whole lot of upside beyond that.
Yeah, he's 6'3", he's 6'3", 210, and in the postseason in college hockey, he did very well at the faceoff dot. That's what I know about Beecher. That's what I've seen from him when I was there and Scott was there. So I don't know how much time we should even waste on that. If we're comparing it to, you know, what pertains to the Bergeron situation, it will be nice to have Mark Diver back on. I think if we can get him on, you know, at some point in the off season to kind of just go through this, you know, the pipeline.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, Bridget, it's it's true what you say, but at the same time, it's sad that you say we don't want to know how much time we want to waste on this, because he's one of like two center prospects that they have, and he's nothing. So it's like, you know, you're right, it's not worth talking about, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know, guys. I mean, we kind of jumped all over, but I don't know if we got.
Yeah, one thing that we haven't mentioned that I just want to touch on, because I think it's super crucial, is you've got to organizationally, whatever coaching, training, whatever program you need to get into, like, you've got to figure out how to get Brandon Carlo right. Like, he is signed through 2027 at $4.1 million a year. And at very few points this season played like that kind of player. Like, he needs to be the anchor on your second pairing. And he stayed mostly healthy this year, and he played there all season, but he was not nearly good enough, and struggled in the playoffs. I think it was, I had it up earlier, but I think he was one of these guys that was on for like 0 goals for at 5-on-5 and like 6 against. And he wasn't even getting buried with like a bunch of defensive zone shifts or anything. So that's just, you know, like, you already committed to him as part of the core of this team. So that's out the window. Like, the idea of moving on from him, I don't think is on the table. I don't know who's trading for him with that contract right now, but you've got to figure something out. And I think Brandon Carlo takes a lot of pride in his game. Like, he's not one of these guys you have to, you know, question if they care or whatever. Like, he does, and he'll put in work, but I don't know. Some, like, everyone's going to get together on that and try to figure out, like, what is the best way to bring back, like, the old Brandon Carlo, like the one from 2019, because if that's not there anymore, and you get more seasons like this, like, that's a huge problem.
Well, I think with Carlo too, I think he relies too much on his reach and not enough on his foot speed. Really, I think he starts to pull up a little bit prematurely on a lot of plays because he knows he has that long stick and he tries to, you know, whatever. I also think he needs to work on his hands. He's not a great puck mover. He's not great at handling the puck under duress. And when you handle the puck well, you make decisions quicker with more confidence. When you're fumbling the puck, you're trying to go up off the glass all the time. You're trying to do indirect passes all the time because you don't have the confidence in your ability to go tape to tape a lot. So, I mean, a lot of it's skill that's just, you know, the player kind of is who he is. I mean, I don't know how much he can really change at this point. I mean, if you don't, you either have it or you don't when it comes to some of that raw ability. But yeah, I don't know. We talked about how he could, you know, earlier in the year when he was really struggling, you know, he's somebody that you could move on from and not really miss a beat because he wasn't bringing you anything that he could, that he should have been. But I don't think that's, and look, if you trade him, it's a loss. I mean, he's a good player for them, but, I think that kind of expendable piece now has kind of shifted to Grizzlick. I don't know how Matt Grizzlick comes back from this. I mean, you're healthy scratch the last two games of the year. You're gonna go through some offseason surgery. The redundancy of him and Riley, and just, you know, I don't know. You got some lefties coming up in the system, Zboril and Lorai. So I don't know.
Yeah, and Carlo. I mean, as of right now, this season, Carlo, he's the second highest paid defenseman, and then you know, it becomes Lindholm once the Lindholm contract, the extension, starts next season. So yeah, Carlo is, next season will be the third biggest cap hit on the defense, just over $4 million, but not really that much more than Grizzlick, though, only about $400,000 more than Grizzlick is getting paid. But I don't know. Yeah, sometimes you wonder what the upside is completely, and you wonder how you'd be able to move this contract because it's a massive contract lengthwise.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, if next year, and again, with Bergeron, without Bergeron, who knows? But if next year comes around and as they approach the trade deadline, it's clear that they aren't making the playoffs or they're not a serious contender at all and they're sellers, they can't be afraid to be sellers if it gets to that. And if it does, that could be a situation where a contender would certainly pay for the services of a Brandon Carlo or a Matt Grzelcyk or something like that. I don't know. I think it's going to have to work itself out. Right now, it's just kind of, you know, who knows. But what you said, Scott's not wrong. I mean, they need him. And you mentioned 2019. The reality is that that Game 7 loss in 19 against the Blues has numbed me to anything else. So when they lost tonight to the Hurricanes, I was just like, yeah, whatever. Like, can't get any worse than losing the cup at home in Game 7. Like, that really did feel just like that was their last kick at the can. Yeah, at least for, you know, I don't know, God knows when. We'll see. Certainly with the Bergeron, Marchand core, I mean, unless they can get some, if Bergeron stays, if they can complete this roster the way that it needs to be, sure, maybe one more kick at it, but I don't know, it's really not looking too bright right now, but we'll see what happens.
About 10 minutes ago, you said something positive, and now we're here.
Oh, well, just, I mean, I'm not wrong. I mean, you had an inferior team on your home ice in front of you, you know, to win the Stanley Cup, and you showed up for 8 minutes, and you could have had two cups out of the three you went to, and everything would have been fine. Like, everything would have been worthwhile. Instead, you
and we still
that.
Freaking get the Tuukka callers at the station about, remember Game 7, how much Tuukka sucked?
The team sucked.
I'm talking about our callers. I'm not saying they're logical or rational. Yeah.
No, but I mean, it's you know, the Bruins get two out of three of those cups, which they absolutely should have. They should have gotten two out of three of those. And it's a total, you get two out of three cups, you can live with some rebuilds. But you know, you get blue balled, you get one cup out of three, and now it's like, well, here we go. It's up in the air. So again, like I said, we've kind of bounced around. I don't really know where you guys want to leave off. There's some big decisions to be made in the Bruins organization though this summer. And it starts with the draft. Well, it starts with Bergeron. You know, Sweeney, we'll see if they re-sign Sweeney. See what happens with Bergeron. Scott said earlier that he thinks that'll probably all shake up before the draft, which I think is in June.
Yeah, and I mean, we didn't even touch on Bruce Cassidy, who the reports about his contract have been that next season is the last. So generally, coaches, you know, don't want to go into the last year of a deal without, you know, a new one. And you wonder, you know, if there is pressure on Sweeney, like, what's always the easiest move for any general manager to make? It's to fire the head coach, and that, you know, that buys you some time to see how a new coach does. But, you know,
coaching market is going to be weird this off season.
Yeah.
Who just got fired? That's really good.
Barry Trotz.
Barry Trotz. Yeah.
Barry. Get Barry.
Hey, Mike Babcock trying to get back in the game.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I don't know. I like Cassidy. I think he's done a great job getting the most out of this group.
I mean, like, what else was
come on.
Like, what else was he supposed to do with this roster? I mean, he pushed as many buttons as he could. He found a lineup that worked that had Jake DeBrusk on the top line, Eric Hall on the second, and Trent Frederick on the third. Like, that's that's like borderline magic.
And when it wasn't that, right? Like, okay, so get this. Last year, you lose to the Islanders because your fourth line gets, you know, totally outplayed by the Islanders' fourth line. So you send Sean Corrali to Columbus. Well, free agency, but, you know. You send Corrali to Columbus. Who the hell was on that fourth line with Corrali and Wagner? I forget who it was. Whatever, regardless. So You bring in Nosek and Foligno and, who, you know, Holla, whatever. It was Lazar with them last year. And you replace Chris Wagner for 82 games and then two playoff games. And then you bring him in, some guy you replace, you bring him back in game three when you're down 2-0. When he's the guy, you bring him in to save the day when you replaced him. That's the lineup that Bruce Cassidy is working with. And oh, by the way, he found a way to win game four without his two top defensemen. So, like, you know, he's done all he can do. It's
if we're doing the whole blame pie, Cassie doesn't get that much.
And look, he's probably not the most beloved coach in the league by his players. Fine. Well, he's their boss, and you don't always have to love your boss, but you have to understand that they're trying to get the best out of you and do what's best for the team and the company. So, like, if you don't like Bruce Cassidy, like, if you're a player, like, tough shit. Like, you don't have to like everybody you work with. So if he's lost
that's,
the
run, so that's my motto for this podcast, guys. That's just here for the contract, get it done and deal with Brian and Scott. I just
hate the whole, like, you know, fire the coach over the players because you can't fire all the players. It's like, I mean,
I totally agree. I'm just saying, like, if there's organizational pressure from above Sweeney, like, that's one move that, you know, general managers tend to resort to.
I know you're not saying it, but anybody with half a brain could look at this situation and say this is not on the coach, and it's and so, I mean, whatever.
So I think what Scott's saying is just it's a scapegoat.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Yeah, but it's yeah, but bring it. Who are you bringing in that's better? Barry Trotz, maybe, fine. But like besides that, who else are you bringing in?
So, it's just a save your own skin move, really. I mean, it wouldn't help at all. So.
But why would management care to say why would ownership care to save face for Sweeney instead of like why not, why do they care if they fire Sweeney?
No, well, I don't think it's ownership. Like, I'm saying, like, Sweeney, you know, and his. I don't know if Sweeney would do this, but like he could, if he's in his exit interviews or whatever, and you know, Cam Neely's trying to say like where to go wrong, Don. He can say, well, you know, I think you know, Bruce Cassidy. Maybe his message is getting a little stale. You know, it might be time for a change there. Like. That's how these things go. So
it's a little bit of a backstabby move. I hope Don Sweeney isn't like that. I don't judge him to be like that, but you never know. And just the most important point of the whole thing is just that it doesn't make sense, and that's not the biggest issue, and that's not like don't waste your energy on going after a new coach and firing your current coach. Yeah.
And I also don't think this would be the case, but like. Unless Patrice Bergeron says, you know, I think Bruce Cassidy might have lost the room or lost some of our guys or something. And
which isn't, he'll never say that.
He wouldn't. But if Patrice Bergeron says, I'll come back if you fire Bruce, then see you, Bruce.
Like, oh, sorry. Yeah, for sure. But like,
that's not happening. But
I mean, if you're Don Sweeney and you give Bruce Cassidy the half-ass fucking bottom six you gave him. And you go and play, oh, yeah, Bruce didn't get the most out of Fliggy and, you know, Smitty and, Freddie and Laser and Nosy. I gave him all the best players out there.
And Stanika.
And Studs. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, that's Bruce's fault because you gave him a bunch of, you know. So that would be the biggest D-bag move of all time.
I gave him Eric Halla, top line center.
So, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I think, but who knows? Maybe the players really dislike him so much and that gets through to the management. I don't know. But anyway, so the Bruins season's over. Done, mercifully, because they weren't going much further. Colorado.
Well, I mean, they could win that second round. Yeah, Rangers and Penguins. Like, those are both beatable teams.
Well, I think if they did beat Carolina, I actually would have felt good about them, certainly against Pittsburgh without Crosby. And the Rangers...
Although it looks like Crosby might be back.
He might play tomorrow.
But they have to...
But they both of those teams, their goaltending hasn't been good. Those have been pretty high-scoring games. Shesterkin, obviously, great regular season, but something's going on in the playoffs. So, I mean, and you're... Pittsburgh, you're... in your goalie depth at this point. So
I was telling Scott earlier before the podcast, like from a just a hockey fan's perspective, like from an entertainment perspective, like having the Bruins in the finals against Colorado as opposed to like Florida or Tampa, as we know now because Toronto's out, like that's just fun hockey to watch, you know, like the Bruins love them to a fault, but they weren't the funnest team to watch necessarily this year. They kind of had that Minnesota Wild of like the 2010s vibe, like couple, you know, some really good players, high end, but then just like a bunch of just like average NHLers that just kind of grinded and didn't even grind that well.
Commonality, Charlie Coyle was on both of those teams.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know, just kind of a boring product. Like, unless you're watching McAvoy or Pastrnak or, you know, Marchand, it was kind of like, I don't want to watch Trent Frederick play hockey or Thomas Nosek. Like, they're boring as hell. Like Curtis Lazar, Foligno, like, this is boring. If I wanted to watch...
I'm not going to lie, watching Chris Wagner was more entertaining than watching some of those guys.
No, seriously, like, dude, at least the Bruins, like, the Bruins of the 2010s, like, early 2010s, like, you know, on their cup runs, like, they had it all, skill, toughness,
they had fourth-line guys that were the most entertaining guys on the team.
But the Bruins, like, this Bruins team, like, they were probably towards the bottom of the league in fighting majors, like, there just wasn't a lot to, like, cling to. And so, as a hockey fan, if the Bruins are now out of it, objectively speaking, like, it's the best teams are going to be in the finals, I think. You know, if the Bruins went on a miracle run, it would have been like, all right, I'll watch. but you know, it was probably a miracle.
Yeah, like, no, Brian, I thought you were going to tune out after the second round and just call it a year.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best teams have advanced so far. I mean, truth be told, Colorado's advanced. We'll see what happens with the Oilers and the Kings. Obviously, the Oilers should advance. The Stars could upset the Flames. That would be a huge upset.
I had Calgary going like fairly far.
The Blues.
I have Calgary winning it all. So
the Blues were.
I could really screw my bracket.
The Blues were deeper offensively than Minnesota. Florida's better than Washington. Tampa's better than Toronto. Like, all these teams are kind of advancing. So
Florida almost shot themselves in the foot completely.
Yeah,
it's wild. No pun intended. It's crazy the way that the Blues have changed just since winning the Cup in 2019. Where like they in that series, the Bruins had more skill, and the Blues were just the more physical, grind it out, like, you know, beat you up type team. And then you look at like this year, and it's the Blues are like one of the most skilled teams in the league. And the Wild, you know, they made moves at the trade deadline to try to get more physical and try to be, you know, more of that in your face, hit everything that moves type team. And then the Blues still take care of them in the first round. Like, the Blues have really like, there's still some players left from that 2019 team, obviously, but they've almost like completely just changed everything about how that team was built.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
which I say, you know, good. A win for skill there. So good for them.
Yeah.
Good for Torrey Krug.
Yeah. Is he
still not going to match up against the Avs at any point? But
is he still hurt? Is he still out of the lineup? I know they're yeah, you know, between series, but
yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen what the latest update is.
That was a pretty vicious hit Zadorov laid on in the Dallas game too, huh?
Yeah, and then his punishment got rescinded. That was, I cannot remember the last time.
What do you mean it got? What do you mean? What happened?
Like, when you appeal it, usually they don't.
I saw he had a hearing. I didn't see that they gave him a punishment in the first place though. Yet from the hearing, did they?
Or what? I don't know. I was only like vaguely following because I think it all happened while the Bruins were playing. But they put out some sort of statement saying like they weren't punishing him.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe Jimmy Benn will drop the gloves with them then in Game 7. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. So they put out a statement announcing, you know, no supplemental discipline and explaining why. But it's like they almost – I cannot remember a time that player safety had – a hearing with a player and didn't issue any discipline. Like,
make it up as you go.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that probably wraps it up for 97, right? You guys, unless you want to keep recording till the sun rises, I'm cool with that too. We can talk any, you know,
no, talk. Man, I'm tired.
You can just carry right into Sunday skate.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. There you go, Scott. You're just going to have to somehow podcast while you drive and get in there in the morning.
Well, I got an early tea time, so I guess I could just, you know, call in remotely and finish it up. But
I gotta be in the studio early too with Scott. So
hell yeah. All right. Well, then that's it for 97. We'll chime back in for 98. You know, throughout the playoffs and just kind of do a episodes every time something happens, and you know, we'll be podcasting throughout the summer too. Just, you know, probably not once a week, but
thank you to everyone who listened all season long. we obviously really appreciate it, and Zeno is great. So this was our, you know, we started like what, middle of last season. So this was our first full season, and hopefully people think we've been getting better. I hope we have. But yeah, just awesome, you know, to see how many people listen, and like I said, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, I echo it. I mean, it's great to be able to just have a platform to just vent every time something happens, good or bad.
It's like, it's therapy, right?
It is therapy. Bridget always points out how we always seem to record an episode after a Bruins loss, so hopefully tonight's no different.
But, no, it's
hey,
like,
but
you know,
we also we had an episode one after one. Yeah, we did an episode after games 3 and 4,
which is last one I can like in a long time that I can remember. But I mean, yeah, I thought Scott was also gonna thank the Academy and maybe his mom a little bit there, but but thank you. Yes,
keep my wife's name out your fucking mouth. All right, that'll wrap it up. We'll be back for episode 98 soon. Thanks for listening.